The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists annual convention and scientific sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the annual clinical assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Metabolic Bone Disease, Therapeutic Measures is presented by Dr. Lewis Hanel IV.
Kind of a quick introduction. I met you before Dr. Barone's presentation, Lou Hanel from originally New Jersey. Now I practice in Charleston, South Carolina. And as fate would have it, another Kennedy trainee, Dr. Jim Fitzpatrick, actually wound up joining me in practice in Charleston, South Carolina, where we now work. He is an internist and has a particular interest in endocrinology, including metabolic bone disease. And so as we were putting this symposium together, I asked him to speak on metabolic bone disease and the update, and he told me that he would, with one caveat, that he had a very important meeting, and as long as it didn't conflict, he would be happy to do it, and as fate would have it, it conflicted. So in full disclosure, he has done all the work, and I am just presenting the data. So happy to be here and do that, and I hope to give it the due justice. That actually is the meeting, yes. Okay. I also have no financial support or disclosures or affiliations. And so our objective today is to talk about metabolic bone disease, talk about bone metabolism, talk about osteoporosis, and give a little bit of an overview about not just the physiology, also the pathophysiology, and then really where we have opportunities for therapeutic management. And I think that we probably have done metabolic bone a very big disservice through the years. It turns out that bone is a very, very dynamic organ. Bone is actually turning itself over and remodeling itself and restructuring itself, and we are still very much in the infancy of our understanding of the processes that are involved with the how and the why of the metabolic bone character. The entire skeleton is turning over about every 10 years. And of course, as we know, there's a very large reservoir of calcium and phosphorus. So when we talk about disorders of calcium metabolism, we are talking about interwoven problems with metabolic bone problems. Similarly, phosphorus metabolic issues also share a very, very common thread with metabolic bone disease. So that bone remodeling is accomplished with a very, very delicate balance. Okay, we all learned back in school about the balance between osteoclasts and osteoblasts. But what I hope to do during this segment is give you a little bit more insight as to how that is happening. And it turns out that the osteocyte and some of the precursor cells are going to differentiate, and they're going to be differentiating by a series of influences. There's a number of different mediators that are involved with cellular development, cellular growth, and the balance and the yin-yang between the osteoclast and that osteoblast cycling. This is a slide you'll see a number of times today, and what this is going to do is kind of take us into the kind of the underpinnings of how the osteocyte is deriving and how that osteocyte is allowing for this balance in metabolic bone health. There are precursor cells, whether those precursor cells are part of the hematopoietic stem cells that will migrate down into the line of osteoclast formation, and also the mesenchymal stem cells that are moving down into the osteoblast derivative. Now, there's a lot of crosstalk between these, and we're going to spend some time today talking about some of that crosstalk. As the mesenchymal stem cells move into the development of osteoblasts, we know, of course, that the osteoblasts are essential for new bone development. We recognize that the balance between remodeling and removal of old bone is largely handled through the osteoclast. The osteocyte is more of the mature bone cell that is actually involved with the signaling and the differentiation of these two cell types. When we talk about a classic description of postmenopausal osteoporosis, let's begin with the discussion about why does the imbalance of postmenopausal osteoporosis move us in the direction of increased osteoclast versus the osteoblast modeling. And what happens is it turns out that sex hormone is a very important modulator, both the androgen as part of the testosterone discussion and the estradiol. These are very important regulators in the bone development and the differentiation of these cells. Now, one of the important concepts that I'm going to touch on as we discuss how estrogen has a role is we need to understand a little bit about the RANK ligand, the osteoprotegerin, and the RANK system. And so it turns out that this system is a very, very important part of how the cells are, number one, recruited, and number two, what their affinity for growth is. So it turns out that the RANK ligand system is a communicator that will move toward the RANK binding. RANK binding occurs on the pre-osteoclasts. And so as these cells are in the process of maturing, when RANK is going to involve itself with allowing for more recruitment and more growth of the osteoclast, it turns out that RANK will continue to promote and facilitate this. Well, RANK ligand, when it binds to it, it further propagates that stimulation down the osteoclast pathway. The balance for how much RANK ligand is able to bind to the RANK receptor is actually mediated through osteoprotegerin. And so osteoprotegerin is a protein that is being controlled and secreted by the osteoblasts. And so the osteoblasts are controlling how much of the osteoclast formation and development is occurring. And so it's creating this signaling mechanism. And so the osteoprotegerin, when it is produced at higher amounts, it binds to the RANK ligand, it occupies the RANK ligand and the osteoprotegerin together, and it therefore inhibits the binding to RANK. If you inhibit the binding to RANK, then that RANK pathway moving toward osteoclast development does not occur. Now, this is an important concept, and it's an important concept therapeutically, because this is actually where denosumab works. So agents like Prolia that we are using every day in our practice are RANK ligand inhibitors. So RANK ligand inhibitors are basically working like osteoprotegerin. They're binding the RANK ligand, and they are disallowing for it to bind to RANK, and therefore we are not allowing the higher production of osteoclasts. Now what that does down the road is that's considered an anti-resorption agent. So we don't have as much breakdown of the bone matrix. We have decreased osteoclast activity. This slide is talking about the influence in postmenopausal because obviously much of our study and our understanding about what has been going on has come from the model of the postmenopausal woman. And it turns out that the estrogen, and you heard me say a moment ago that the testosterone as well, but certainly estrogen is a bigger part of this discussion, is involved with expression of RANK ligand and is involved with some of the receptors on the RANK. And it turns out that when estrogen levels start to wane, you actually will then see more RANK binding sites and there becomes a greater affinity for increased osteoclast activity. So that delicate balance between clast and blast that is kept in a very, very even level in the premenopausal state, now that estrogen levels begin to wane, now we see an imbalance of increased osteoclast activity and compromise of the osteoblastic effect. And again, that has to do with estrogen's influence on a lot of the RANK binding sites. Now, as we get older, and as we have stressors that may be part of this process, we understand that this also is a contributing factor in metabolic bone disease. There's a tremendous amount of signaling that goes on in terms of allowing our bodies to develop more new healthy bone tissue. So the osteoblast that is going to be making and developing from those mesenchymal cells more healthy bone tissue is under control of signaling peptides. WNT is one of these signaling peptides, and sclerostin is an important signaling peptide. And so it turns out that as these communicate and crosstalk with one another, their influence on the osteoblast is very important. Sclerostin, for example, is actually an inhibitor of osteoblast function. And WNT is a promoter and a stimulator of osteoblast function and growth. As we get older and we increase oxidative stress, our ability to stimulate by WNT crosstalk becomes lessened. Interestingly, the sclerostin was a very, very hot topic, and I'll touch on this briefly in a little bit later on in the talk, but sclerostin inhibitor therapy was a very, very hot topic as a new bone-developing therapeutic agent. It turns out that this was well in clinical development. It was beyond phase 3 clinical studies. There were over 16,000 patients enrolled, and it was showing tremendous new healthy bone growth. Unfortunately, there were some wrinkles with respect to accelerated calcification on vascular intima. And so that product line has actually been pulled. And as we speak right now, it's not likely to make it to market. And I don't know that any of the sclerostin inhibitors are actually going to make it to market. But it's an interesting part of this discussion. So the sclerostin topic was a topic we didn't talk about a number of years ago. But it is intimately involved with this signaling mechanism that is going on at the level of this very, very dynamic metabolic bone process. Glucocorticoids, of course, we recognize that high-dose glucocorticoid therapy, which we use every day in practice for a variety of different reasons, also have a balance and an influence on that ratio between osteoblast and osteoclast activity. And influencing and increasing the glucocorticoid in the system will also have impact on osteoprotegerin and the RANK ligand system. And specifically, it's going to influence the osteoprotegerin so that there becomes more RANK ligand that then can bind to RANK, which then stimulates the development of the osteoclast line. So increases osteoclast versus blast, which leads us more toward the osteoporosis direction. So let's talk a moment about what it means to have the terminologies that I've been using and, of course, you're very familiar with, and that is, what is osteoporosis? And, of course, when we talk about that, we talk about the clinical diagnosis. We talk about fragility fractures, and they're defined as fractures that occur from an event that should not have really created a fracture. A fall, someone drops to the ground and has a fracture. Much of the time, that's considered more of a fragility-based fracture because healthy bone matrices would not typically experience a fracture in that context. So we look at those types of pictures and profiles as fragility fractures that raise the clinical suspicion that the bone is thinner than it should be. We look at certain sites very historically, radial ulnar areas. We look at vertebral areas, which of course are a very important part as part of the vertebral fractures and the compression fractures that can occur, and of course the hip femur areas. And we recognize that when we talk about osteoporosis at these sites, not only do they provide a very, very reasonable surrogate marker for bone health, they are focusing on trabecular bone, which is really what becomes very heavily impacted, especially in the postmenopausal female. But we also recognize that the impact of bone health and its influence, especially at these areas, has a very, very high concern for comorbidity and for mortality. And so our ability to not only understand these influences, but to modulate these influences is very, very important as part of our clinical practice. When we talk about what osteoporosis means, we talk about using DEXA scans. And as we use DEXA scans, what those are basically providing for us is an opportunity to look at standard deviations. So when we look at a T score on a patient, when we order our bone densitometry on a patient, what we're really doing is we're looking at how thick and how dense is that patient's bone compared to others. Now, if we look at a T score, that comparison is to the most aggressive and thickest that a person's bone would typically be. And historically, it's about the age of 30 in a woman. So a 70-year-old postmenopausal woman who you might send for a bone density study, when you get a T-score result, we are looking at her bone thickness compared to a 30-ish-year-old female. A Z-score is looking at that woman with her age-matched controls. And most of us that are doing this and involve ourselves with the management of metabolic bone disease don't put a lot of use in the Z-score. So we specify a lot in that T-score. Now, what does it mean when you look at that T-score? What you're doing is you're looking at standard deviations from that thickness. And as you get thinner, you create different nomenclature. So a -1 to -2.5 standard deviations is considered osteopenia. You can be up to -1 and still considered normal. -1 to -2.5 is osteopenia, and anything less than -2.5 is osteoporosis. So there is the definition of what we create with osteopenia and osteoporosis. So when we look at things that create thinning of the bone, i.e. osteoporosis, postmenopausal, we talked about, the aging concept does it. Juvenile is obviously less clinically important. Adult idiopathic, and so when someone comes to you that has thin bones, has perhaps had a fragility fracture, we as certainly as endocrinologists, and I would argue you every day in practice, may see patients that have had episodes. A lot of times a workup for what may be contributory in this bone metabolic problem to try to figure out where the defect may be and what we might be able to do to improve and perhaps offer treatment for these patients. So this is obviously a very long slide, maybe difficult for some of you to see in the back, but this is part of the task that we get in terms of if we see someone that has thinning bone, what types of things might we look for? So of course, hyperparathyroidism is an important part of that discussion. We recognize now that we have calcium on our autoanalyzers, we are picking up patients with mild hypercalcemia that are often related to mild cases of primary hyperparathyroidism. Okay, 99.99% of the time, these are benign adenomas. Adenomas typically occur because of what's called a G-peptide abnormality. There becomes constitutive activity of the G-peptide signaling mechanism where these adenomas get turned on a little higher than they should be, and so their PTH level becomes higher. The influence of PTH taking calcium out of bone and raising the blood calcium level becomes greater. And the kidney tries to help the body out to keep the calcium balance by facilitating a greater degree of calciuresis. But the problem can then become is, number one, we increase the risk of calcium-based kidney stones, and unfortunately, the kidney can only keep up with so much of that demand, so very commonly, as it supersedes that ability for calciuresis, we'll start to see hypercalcemia to begin. And so this is a very common entity and contributing factor for secondary causes of osteoporosis. Nowadays that we have accurate, what we call sandwich assays for the PTH molecule, we are doing two-site assays that are ICMA-IRMA sites, so no longer do we talk about N-terminal and C-terminal sequences. We have a very, very accurate ability to measure that parathyroid hormone. So when you have a patient that has high calcium, your next step should be to measure an intact PTH to identify and screen for the possibility of primary hyperparathyroidism. Vitamin D deficiency, of course, has been a big topic. I actually presented at the ACOI a couple years ago on vitamin D. Vitamin D has become the next coming, and it's going to cure everything that ails you. The problem with vitamin D has been is that if you look at well-designed, randomized, placebo-designed trials, there actually is a paucity of value in giving patients back vitamin D. I'm not suggesting that vitamin D doesn't have value, but I'm suggesting that we look at epidemiologic studies about patients that have breast cancer, and if you look at the breast cancer arm versus age-matched controls, they have lower vitamin D levels. Similarly, you look at type 2 diabetics, they have lower vitamin D levels. But if you create randomized studies and you look to see if giving vitamin D back has clinical value, to date, the value has been very, very weak. Now, there clearly is value in vitamin D and its role on metabolic bone, because vitamin D is absolutely a very, very important substrate and part of the matrix for good, healthy bone metabolism. Other things that we talk about that accelerate bone turnover, such as hyperthyroidism, we recognize that thyrotoxicosis is accelerating bone turnover, and there becomes a relative imbalance between the clast and blast. And so I tell patients that we may be following conservatively with subclinical hyperthyroidism. My two biggest concerns for you are tachyarrhythmias and increasing your risk of osteoporosis. So this is definitely something that we think about. Cushing's disease, Cushing's syndrome is less commonly an issue. Men that come to me with fragility fractures, I'm absolutely looking for the potential for testosterone deficiency. Obviously, we've talked about that impact in women as well. Other conditions such as malnutrition, malabsorption problems, that by extension, cystic fibrosis, part of that. Thalassemias can have a contribution. Hemochromatosis can be part of that, as it has influence on many endocrine organs. Primary biliary cirrhosis, probably also related to some of the malabsorption issues. Okay, so obviously some of the smaller and lower down risks and contributing factors for secondary osteoporosis kind of round out that list. So when we try to target our management for proper bone health to our patients, we look at a number of different things. We, of course, look at getting patients to have adequate calcium levels. And there's kind of been discussion going on for a number of years now about how much calcium is helpful and is too much calcium hurtful. And we recognize the body typically has a reasonable capacity to excrete calcium. It also has a reasonable ability to not absorb that calcium intestinally in the gut. But when we give too much calcium, a question that was raised a number of years ago is, could we be intensifying calcification at the vascular intima? Are we accelerating the potential for atherosclerosis, coronary artery disease, cerebrovascular disease? They've done some subsequent follow-up studies that don't suggest that that holds a lot of credibility. So if you have a patient on 2,000 milligrams a day, there's not a strong amount of data to suggest that it truly does increase that atherosclerotic risk. But I would say to you, you have to use caution. And so what I have done in my practice, I've dialed back a little bit, and my target is usually closer to 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium supplement in my osteoporotic patients. Vitamin D supplementation, again, I think it's an important part in metabolic bone health. Excuse me. So if you look at the statistics and you look at patients and data put out by the World Health Organization, the number of patients that have vitamin D deficiency is extraordinarily high. So whether that is an epidemiologic fluke or whether patients really do have low vitamin D, the message I think is clear in the management of metabolic bone health is that certainly if a patient has osteoporosis, screen their vitamin D, and absolutely it's reasonable to give them vitamin D supplementation. It's actually pretty hard to make someone vitamin D toxic. Okay, yes, it is a fat-soluble hormone slash vitamin, but it is pretty difficult to make them toxic on that. So I don't have a lot of concern, and I will usually try to get them on about 2,000 international units per day. You know, of course, that there are patients that are very deficient where we're often using pharmaceutical and very high levels, 50,000 units weekly, and sometimes even more than that if they have malabsorption problems. So we're very quick and comfortable in using certainly those first two therapies. Now, bisphosphonate therapies have been around for a long, long time. We'll break this down a little bit more, but some of the American College of Physicians is now really underscoring the fact that bisphosphonates should be at our first line of treatment for that osteoporotic patient. And it's something we've done for a long time, but you know as well as I do, there's a tremendous amount of literature now in the orthopedic world, and there's also a lot in the dental world about the potential for atypical fractures, whether we're talking about mandibular difficulties, osteonecrosis of the jaw, or we're talking about unusual subtrochanteric fractures. These are on people's radars now. So we are thinking about the value of using bisphosphonate therapy, but we are being a little smarter in the application of their use. The selective estrogen receptor modulators, such as raloxifene or Avista, these are drugs that are probably used less commonly. And again, if you look at the new ACP guidelines, they're going to be used even less commonly than they've been used in the course of the last 5 years. Because of some of the kind of off-bone concerns of those therapies. We'll get into that in just a moment. Okay, calcitonin, which is used very infrequently. Having said that, I just wrote it for a guy about 2 weeks ago who had a fragility fracture, who I did a full workup on and couldn't really find a problem. Why did I put him on calcitonin as opposed to a better option? Because the fracture had occurred many weeks ago and he's still having a considerable amount of pain. And calcitonin is one of the few favorable osteoporotic therapeutic agents that also has an analgesic benefit. And there's been a number of clinical studies to show a bony analgesic value. I saw him back in follow-up and it helped him zero, but I hoped that it would. But that was that's what the literature tells us anyway. Rank ligand inhibitors, we'll talk a little bit more. Parathyroid hormone, I'll also get into a minute. I touched briefly on sclerostin inhibitors and cathepsin, I'll mention as well. Okay, calcium, I think I covered some of this already. I'd use about 1,200 milligrams a day. You can also argue what is the best calcium to give a patient. I think most of us give calcium carbonate. There's certainly some literature talking about the value of calcium gluconate and calcium chloride in patients. And there's also some concerns if patients have had bariatric surgery, they may not absorb the calcium carbonate molecule quite as well. So something to consider. As we mentioned, if you give too much, yes, you may increase the risk of nephrolithiasis. And whether that increases the cardiovascular risk, we kind of discussed on briefly just a moment ago. Vitamin D, talking about its value in bone health, we discussed that a little bit. Deficiency is considered below 20, low values are considered below 30. So we get many patients, especially those that do have defined metabolic bone disease, I definitely want to try to get them above 30. Know also that when you're looking at vitamin D and trying to establish where their levels are, when we do a measured value for vitamin D, what we should be measuring is the 25-hydroxyvitamin D. 125-dihydroxycholecalciferol, the 125 component, also known as calcitriol, is a very important metabolic bone hormone. And that is, of course, the 1-alpha-hydroxylation that occurs largely at the level of the kidney and is very compromised in patients that have renal impairment. That is the more metabolically active component of the molecule. And so calcitriol is a vitamin D flavor, but that molecule is very much regulated. Okay, that's a medicine that you need a prescription for. You're not getting over-the-counter calcitriol. You can't get over-the-counter 125 preparation. So when patients take over-the-counter preparations, they're doing more of the 25 type variety. Okay. So let's jump to some of these therapies, just so you understand, kind of back to this slide that I made reference to, and we talk about where mechanisms of action will occur. So the bisphosphonates are actually going to work through the osteoclast, and they are going to blunt the activity of the osteoclast so that we lessen the degradation of the bone. And you're familiar with many of the bisphosphonates that have been available through the years. Okay, alendronate, resedronate, zoledronic acid, abandronate. And so Dr. Fitzpatrick really kind of delved through a lot of the data. I'm not going to have time to dissect all this. He actually left me with over 60 slides that I know you don't want me to tear through aggressively, so I'm going to tear through them very quickly and give you the abridged version on these. But he did a very nice outline. And basically the outline in summation was that most of the value is going to come from the ibandronate or the Boniva is probably the least favorable because it hasn't shown as good benefit at the two important sites, the femoral neck and the vertebral. But your alendronate, your resedronate, your zoledronic acid have shown very good reduction, vertebral fracture reduction and hip fracture reduction. We've been using these therapies a long time. We have good safety data. And as you heard me mention a little bit ago, these are really the preferred options if you look at the American College of Physician guidelines. The thing that we are doing now are recognizing the need for giving patients holidays off treatment. And it turns out that when you are binding to this osteoclast and you're influencing this remodeling effect, that balance is offset in somewhat of a negative way over years and years and years at some of the very long bone sites. And that's where the subtrochanteric fracture risks became higher. So what many of us are doing now in practice, and the guidelines are not really strong and in support of this, but many of us that deal with metabolic bone disease, we're looking at patients for treatment for 5 consecutive years, we will give them a holiday off treatment. And when we give them a holiday, we may have them on no therapy. When I say no therapy, they're on calcium and vitamin D, but they may be on no new bisphosphonate, or they may not be on a Prolia. Or we may switch them to a different class. We may switch them to a Prolia through a RANK ligand inhibitor. We may put them to a PTH analog. We may put them on something different. But I think the wisdom is to give them a holiday if they've been on 5 consecutive years of a bisphosphonate, put them either on no bisphosphonate or on a different class. Don't switch them within class. And I've seen this. Patients do this. They've been getting zoledronic acid for the last 5 years, and their doctor said, well, I know I need to give you a holiday. I'm now going to switch you over to alendronate. Well, that's the same mechanism of action, so you haven't really conveyed the value of drug holiday. And so for whatever reason, these subtrochanteric concerns, these fracture concerns exist at that level of that long bone, but these concerns are actually very, very minimal. Okay, we're talking about them. Orthopedists are talking about them, but the concerns are actually quite modest. Similarly, the concerns about bisphosphonate and the resorption at the level of the jaw is really a very, very modest concern. It's typically in very ill patients. It's not your run-of-the-mill osteoporotic patient. It's a patient who's been very sick. Most of the data sets are replete with patients that have had advanced cancer stages, that are looking at chemotherapeutic treatments for a number of years. These are patients that are on bisphosphonates for protection of their bone or lessening some of the bony involvement of the malignancy. These are the patients where the accelerated resorption of jaw osteonecrosis was a potential concern. Okay. So this just kind of has the osteonecrosis. As I said, it's really very rare, although we are talking about it. Calcitonin, again, you've heard me say this has that bony analgesic value. This actually turns down some of the osteoclast activity. There's actually a calcitonin receptor that sits right on the osteoclast, and it deregulates osteoclast activity that therefore has some value in heightening the osteoblast to osteoclastic ratio. Because its mechanism of action has been so modest and so really very weak, this on the newer guidelines is not recommended as a first-line therapy for osteoporosis, but understand that it is an option. The option that we use is, incidentally, a calcitonin that's derived from salmon that actually has a higher degree of activity in us. And so nasal insufflation of the salmon calcitonin is actually what we use in clinical practice if we choose to use it. Okay, so estrogen-based therapies are still in favor, especially women that go through either premature menopause, they have premature ovarian failure, they've had hysterectomy with bilateral oophorectomies, whatever the case may be where they go through early menopause, using estrogen therapy to a normal age of menopause, or, you know, be around the age of 50, still has very, very reasonable judgment. We can talk about the Women's Health Initiative and the good, bad, and the ugly, but certainly even if you look at the Women's Health Initiative, the value in metabolic bone health in women on estrogen therapy is absolutely clear. And so it works through the RANK system as we spoke about. Excuse me. Agents that are selective estrogen receptor modulators are working through some of the estrogen sites. So again, that's the raloxifen or the Avista that is available in clinical practice. They have certain binding sites at certain locations of estradiol, and they have blocking effects at other sites. The real value of Avista was, yes, it does restore some of the estrogen benefit at the level of the bone. Therefore, therapies like raloxifen do help with osteoporosis management. But interestingly, it also shares crosstalk with tamoxifen, which is an estrogen receptor blocker. And so they actually designed a trial called the STAR trial, and Avista actually showed lessening of breast cancer rates because of its blunting of some of that estradiol receptor effect off bone target sites. Okay. RANK ligand therapy, again, I mentioned this a little bit ago, so the Prolia, There's actually, so which is denosumab, has been the agent out for a while, and we actually have now 10-year safety data. This class also is approved as part of the ACP guidelines as first-line therapy. Because of its efficacy and because of its safety data, it's on a parallel plane with the bisphosphonates as first-line therapeutic options. And again, what they do is they influence the RANK ligand with respect to RANK binding. So it acts as a RANK ligand binder so that the RANK receptor cannot continue to promote a higher level of osteoclast. And so this also is considered an anti-resorptive agent. The FREEDOM trial was the recent extension study. 8 years he has, but we actually have data out in 10 years for some of the pre-marketing of it. Agents that work through the parathyroid hormone are an interesting discussion. And so we have agents like FORTEO or teriparatide, which is actually a parathyroid hormone-like molecule. Now, we think about parathyroid hormone, and you heard me mention a little bit ago that looking for secondary causes of osteoporosis, you want to make sure that you've checked the patient for primary hyperparathyroidism, because the nature of too much parathyroid in the system will resorb calcium out of bone and will thin the bone. So the paradoxical teaching concept here is that if you have that condition where a patient has a parathyroid adenoma, they are always making high levels of parathyroid, and that parathyroid impact is to create more weaning of calcium from the bone, thinning of the bone, and it heightens that osteoclast activity and leans us in the direction of osteoporosis. But something very curious happens. If you give the same parathyroid molecule in a pulsatile fashion, you actually change the influence at the receptor, and you actually develop a biologic increase in osteoblastic activity, and you generate new bone formation. So a pulsatile delivery of a once-daily injection like a FORTEO therapy actually increases new bone development. And it is one of the best developers of new healthy bone tissue. So this is in a different basket. This is not an anti-resorptive agent. It is actually a bone growth promoting agent. And there are a number of orthopedists, and I've actually been using this recently in my practice, as new bone formation in patients that have had fracture. So we're not talking about osteoporotic fracture. We're talking about Terrell Owens, as a matter of fact, when he was the receiver for the Eagles before the Super Bowl. If anyone remembers, he broke his fibula 3 weeks before the Super Bowl, and he was amazingly able to play in the Super Bowl. And I don't know for certain because I wasn't his treating physician, but the rumor was that he was given agents like FORTEO because of that advanced bone formation. Very, very good in that capacity. Okay, this again is some of the WNT crosstalk that I was mentioning, its influence on sclerostin. And so sclerostin is going to be involved with inhibiting osteoblast formation, so therefore sclerostin inhibitors allow the osteoblast to form more effectively. These drugs may or may not make it to pipeline, but currently nothing is available. The parathyroid hormone we talked about. So teriparatide, again, is the one, the FORTEO, it's been out for quite a while. The abaloparatide has just recently been approved. So we now have two agents in that parathyroid hormone injectable class at this time. And this is kind of talking about some of the markers. So sclerostin inhibitors, you heard me say, are really not, we're not going to concentrate on because they're not available yet and may not be available. Okay, we talked about the cardiovascular concerns on that. Cathepsin K was another potential therapeutic arm. This is also another very important, it's a kind of an enzymatic player, and it allows the osteoclast to engage on the bone matrix. And so modulation of the cathepsin was going to compromise or lessen the osteoclast's ability to get into that bony matrix and resorb, therefore improving the blast to clast ratio. But unfortunately, this also had these vascular concerns, and so the cathepsin K inhibitors are not quite ready for prime time. This slide, just briefly I'll mention, we may be able to talk about some combination therapies. So there's kind of an infancy of data and information talking about some of these combination therapies because, again, you know, just like Dr. Barone had mentioned about complementary and synergistic methods of action of how we may treat diabetes, when we tackle metabolic bone disease, agents that work through different mechanisms may have that synergistic value. Okay. So this is basically a summation slide talking about the bone remodeling and the balance between blastic and clastic activity. We've talked about kind of some of these nuances. We talked about drug holiday, but how to manage your patients and still keep them on calcium, how to keep them on vitamin D, where to consider maybe using alternative therapies.